the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Some of the most fun things to watch when candidates start running for their presidential party nomination are the opinion polls. One out this week shows that while more than half of California Democrats are excited for Senator Kamala Harris's bid, they're even more excited for someone that hasn't even decided to run, or at least not yet. Find out who when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering 3 psychology master's degrees this April. Priority deadline to apply for summer term scholarship is February 15th at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Happy Friday to you. It's the official post-Super Bowl hangover weekend. Nothing really going on in sports. Pitchers and catchers, though. Dodgers and Angels report next week, so there's that to look forward to. All right, coming up, turns out electric cars, well, they're not a fan of the cold weather that we've been having, and a lot of them are actually losing some juice.
For the average driver driving around in these temperatures, they're going to see their ranges drop.
How EVs are affected by the weather and how to protect your battery from the cold. That's coming up. First, though, State of Affairs. That's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And this week, as the 2020 presidential race heats up, Democratic hopefuls look to California for some campaign cash. Meanwhile, Congressman Adam Schiff is back in the spotlight as the House Intelligence Committee reopens its investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. We'll get into those stories and more this week with Marisa Lagos, political reporter at KQED. Welcome, Marisa.
Hey.
Also with us, Rafe Sonnenschein. He directs the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Welcome back, Rafe.
Hello, A.
All right, Tom Marisa, start us off. California's long been a political cash machine, ATM city here. What early role does it seem to be playing in the 2020 election so far?
Well, just that. We've already seen Kamala Harris, Cory Booker announce or hold fundraisers in both cases. And you guessed it, L.A. and Silicon Valley. Shocking. We're hearing rumors of Joe Biden coming to town, Julian Castro. So I think there's going to be a long line of folks lining up. And, you know, it's a little different this year. I think for now they're really going to be focusing on fundraising because, you know, they need to show a strong first quarter. But I think after that, we'll also see them coming and doing campaign events because we're going to be part of Super Tuesday. And it's that does change the dynamics. I think, you know, depending on who is kind of leading the charge, some folks might peel off and say, you know, if Kamala looks really strong, hey, we'll let her have California. But it could be up for grabs. And I think it's not, we're not just going to be an ATM this time, A. I have hope.
Well, I'm wondering, Rafe, okay, so maybe aside from that, or unless it is the only reason, what is it about California that makes it such an attractive campaign stop? Because I know billionaires have always worried that someone loves them only for their money.
Well, I think Marissa's exactly right. It's no longer a cash machine. And in fact, the push for small donors keeps growing in the Democratic Party. So raising money from rich people is getting less and less popular. What's really striking, though, is that California is really important in the National Democratic Party now, probably for the first time ever. You've got Pelosi as speaker. You've got Adam Schiff and Maxine Waters heading committees. You've got investigations on Capitol Hill being led by Californians. Pelosi has put Californians into all kinds of key committee positions. California is now part of the narrative of national politics, which it really, believe it or not, really hasn't been, really maybe ever. And that means that if you want to stay in the conversation, especially with the March primary, you better be out here talking to people. And you have to decide how hard you're going to play in that California primary. I don't think anyone's going to concede it to Harris.
And it's a nice change, I think, for candidates, right? I mean, because, as you said, California, Rafe, has never been a state that they needed to kind of worry about in that way for a long time.
Well, what they used to do is raise money from California, then pretend they were never out here because essentially people would make fun of California. They'd call people San Francisco Democrats. Well, the second most powerful person in the country right now is a San Francisco Democrat who is kind of winning a lot. So, but they would come out here almost quietly because they didn't want to be associated with California. Now it's like, I'm going to California. There's big things happening here.
And I think it does change the dynamic, eh? Because, you know, if all of your focus has been historically on these early caucus states in the Midwest and then South, you probably are striking a slightly different message than in a state like California. I mean, the one thing we should say is that it's not possible to do the type of campaigning here that you would do in an Ohio or a South Carolina, right? You cannot do the, like, fairs and handshakes and meet every 40 million Californians.
Yeah.
So that takes money because you got to talk to them on TV and through media and other ways, and hopefully by talking to people like us, right?
Absolutely.
You know,
I would.
I think that
I'm not running,
right?
By the
come
way.
On
I'm,
down.
I want to make an announcement. I am not running for anything.
No,
except
but we want them
the
to come and talk
my high
to
school.
Us. Right, but I think they'll be coming and thinking about not just the national media, but talking to local media in some of the markets and places that they see an opportunity for a pickup. And so, you know, I think how that changes messaging will be kind of fascinating to watch as the primaries approach.
And just one more thing on this, Rafe. Most of the money, Northern California or Southern California?
Actually, most of the money is Southern California, except for Silicon Valley. Okay. I mean, Silicon Valley, but even that's become ambivalent. But the heart of Democratic fundraising has been greater Los Angeles for literally for decades, especially since Bill Clinton began to come out here. And I think one of the funny things about this is the non-California candidates can get a buzz by going to California and doing well, and a California candidate like Harris will get a buzz by doing well in Iowa and South Carolina. It's how you do where you're not from that actually sometimes is the measure of you.
Which kind of makes me wonder if Beto O'Rourke decides to run, when he made a living pretty much off the small donor thing. So I'm wondering, you know, if he decides to do it, if that's going to be his big strategy in California. Now, Marisa, as you mentioned, Kamala Harris is one of the early candidates benefiting from the Golden State's Green. So let's focus on her for just a second. A recent poll out of Quinnipiac University reveals that potential voters are actually a bit divided on her candidacy. What did it show?
Well, yeah, if you look at all voters, which isn't surprising, she's running for the Democratic nomination. I think it showed about 38% not super excited, 40% pretty excited. But if you look at Democrats, she had something like approaching 60% approval, people saying that they were excited about her candidacy. That's who she's looking at right now. And I think realistically, you know, California is a blue state, so that's who she needs to worry about most seriously. You know, it's interesting, I think, in those polls, you see the fact that even as a statewide elected official, she still needs to work on name ID, not just in California, or not just nationally, but in parts of California, probably. But I think it was good news for Harris. And I think it shows that she has really, you know, owned this rollout of this campaign and done a good job of coming out early and staking some claim. I think, you know, if a Joe Biden does get in the race, that will sort of mix up these numbers a little bit. But, you know, the Democrats I talk to are excited about a big field of candidates. You mentioned Beto O'Rourke. I can see a lot of the sort of grassroots energy in the Bay Area giving money and time to both candidates in the beginning and seeing who kind of rises above the rest of the pack. I don't think for a lot of Democrats at this point, it's a zero-sum game. Now, that's not the case, of course, for big donors. You know, Rafe mentioned L.A. Obviously, Hollywood in particular has been sort of a huge source of Democratic donations over the years. But we have seen Silicon Valley kind of rise up and start to play more. One of the biggest Clinton donors, Susie Tompkins Buell, announced that she is backing Kamala Harris. And that was a big win for her. But I think, again, like, it's going to be also a test for her of how many small donors she can excite across the nation, because that has become the sort of litmus test for how strong a Democratic candidate it is.
Well, Rafe, let's get into someone that Marisa mentioned, former Vice President Joe Biden, who Politico's Carlo Marinucci called one of the bees, along with Beto O'Rourke and all that. He made a surprisingly strong showing in that poll. Kamala Harris had 58%. 60% of the people polled were very excited, or if he ran. He's currently not running. So I'm wondering, Rafe, name recognition, is that the biggest hurdle?
It's a huge thing. And also, people are very excited about you until you run. And they get all the qualms about it. So he's what you might call a soft front runner. I think Harris is a bit stronger than a soft front runner. Nobody knows the day he announces if he drops 10 or 15 points or if he takes off. He's certainly not prohibitive. Nobody's afraid of him, but Democrats like him. So he may end up making the argument that you may all fight among each other, but everybody likes me, everybody likes Joe. and then people fight for the VP. But he's going to really have to earn this one. He's going to really have to fight for it.
Rafe, what you just mentioned is the classic backup quarterback theory, in
Absolutely.
That the fans in the stands love the backup quarterback because there's, you know, you don't know anything. There's so much potential possibly, and if the starter stinks, you know, everyone loves the backup. So that's kind of like the thing. Once he jumps on the field, though, it could be a different story. And Harris has been considered a top-tier contender in the race. Again, it's still very early. What's going to take, though, for Kamala Harris, Rafe, to build on her name recognition over the next few months?
It's really hard to say. I mean, she got off to such a great start that, you know, it's hard to maintain that. But she has to keep adding supporters in places where, you know, people wouldn't expect her to have as much support. And usually that's going to be Iowa and New Hampshire. So isn't it ironic that with California moving to the head of the pack, the California candidate's best chance to show strength is everywhere but California, because she's in the odd position where if she doesn't win California by a lot, people will say, well, it's your state. You didn't win by a lot. If she wins by a lot, they'll say, oh, yeah, of course, it's your state. Mm-hmm. You have much more to gain by gaining elsewhere, which is really kind of ironic.
Marisa, one more thing on this. When it comes to the people that are left that we've speculated might want to run, is there like a race to finish last in terms of who runs last? Last person that gets the big headlines?
Well, I don't know about that. I think it depends on who you are. So maybe a Biden who already has that built-in fundraising prowess and name ID would sort of make that bet. I think for everyone else, they're looking to make a mark with just coming out in a strong manner, probably as soon as possible, quite frankly, so that they can start that fundraising and really start going hard. I think, you know, coming out last, I mean, maybe it seems like maybe Beto's making that calculation. But I do think that that's a little bit of a risky proposition if you haven't run nationally before and you don't have that donor base, because, again, this is going to be an expensive primary and, of course, an even more expensive probably general election.
Talking State of Affairs with Marisa Lagos, political reporter at KQED, also Rafe Sonnenschein. He directs the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. All right, now, the House Intelligence Committee this week announced that it's reopening the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. When Republicans, Marisa, ran the House, they'd been accused of protecting Donald Trump. Now, Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff is at the helm. So I'm wondering what the reason has he given for reopening this investigation?
Well, I mean, Democrats were never happy with what Republicans came out with and, you know, basically killing that investigation. And so Schiff is saying that he's going to go, you know, beyond Russia to look more broadly at what the president is doing. He's been getting a lot of anger from Trump this week. What he is saying is essentially we need to look at whether any decisions this president is making are being influenced by outside actors, other governments, and whether specifically Trump's finances come into play with any of that. So I think this is going to be fascinating to watch. I think that, you know, Adam Schiff hiring some National Security Council staffers, or at least one, really got the White House kind of hot under the collar. And it's a sort of interesting matchup, you got to say. Like Adam Schiff, who is this very deliberative, sort of steady guy going up against Trump, who, you know, has a bit of a temper, I'll say.
No, yeah, and that really did upset the president. He sent out a series of very angry tweets.
A lot of tweets.
Yeah. Rafe, in the committee's first official meeting, it voted to share interview transcripts from the last session with the Justice Department, and President Trump has reacted to Congressman Schiff's actions by calling them presidential harassment. How is Schiff's investigation at this point different from what Robert Mueller's doing?
Well, Robert Mueller is looking at potential criminal activity. A congressional investigation is looking at what happened in public so people can see what occurred. And they're not limited to indictments and things like that. They really don't really have that kind of power. However, where the two intersect is that the Republican Intelligence Committee would not make available the transcripts of testimony to Robert Mueller in order to protect people who were testifying. And now Schiff has said all along, the minute the Democrats get control of that committee, they're going to pass those transcripts over to Mueller, who can then assess whether or not they lied in front of Congress. It may be that people didn't realize that lying to Congress is a crime, but, you know, I guess I'd have to give people some chance to say that. But
I could lie to myself, Rafe, but I don't know if I could lie to Congress.
Usually when you take an oath, usually that probably means you know that. the president calls this harassment. You know, I think it's pretty much traditional oversight, but I think he's never experienced it before and tends to think that everybody in the administration is a personal employee of his. So the National Security Council is basically professionals. And if they get pulled in, that's not that unusual to work for a congressional committee. But in his view, anybody in the executive branch is somebody who's, you know, part of the company.
Marisa, let's just say that Schiff and his committee do uncover wrongdoing. How much power do they have to do something?
Well, I mean, I think what they have more than anything else is the power of the bully pulpit. Obviously, if they uncover anything criminal, they would hand that over to prosecutors. And I think that if they found something, you know, that they felt that could lead to, say, an impeachable offense, they could clearly hold those sorts of hearings. I don't think Democrats, you know, have any hope that a Senate would go along with that. And I think there's a lot of political considerations there. I mean, again, I think that's what's interesting about this. If you look at the way Pelosi has acted, Speaker Pelosi, you know, since the election and how they've talked about these investigations, having such a steady person as Adam Schiff, a former prosecutor in that position, they are being very cautious. And so I think that what they really want to be able to do is uncover this stuff. And if possible, if it's not classified, show it to the American people. It really is, in a lot of ways, more of a political probe than anything else. Of course, you know, again, if they uncover wrongdoing, they're going to share that with Mueller's team. And I think that we've already seen Mueller use some of those transcripts against folks like Roger Stone. So, you know, it's not as if it's a far cry. Yeah. Like you can understand why Trump would be so mad about this.
Now, Marisa, I'm moving from one California lawmaker to another. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. We're not going to talk about the clap scene around the internet. Specifically,
okay,
it was a funny picture, actually. But specifically, her response to the Green New Deal. That's the environmental resolution co-sponsored by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It was released to the real media fanfare yesterday. And despite that, the House Speaker did not seem to give it a lot of attention. Marisa, how has Nancy Pelosi responded to it?
Well, in her first interview about it, I think prior to the unveiling of the details, she called it, the Green Dream or whatever they're calling it. So it was a little dismissive. I think she came back and tried to clarify a little bit. And, you know, I think she feels like defensive a little bit that climate change is something that she feels like has been a key issue for her. And she doesn't want somebody else to take the mantle. But, you know, I think a lot of this speaks to the generational differences we're seeing in Congress and the star power of somebody like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's coming in with, you know, Twitter and Instagram followings that just dwarf most other members of Congress and has been able to use that to really push the public narrative. I think what people like Pelosi are saying is, you know, slow your roll a little bit. This is still Congress. There's still seniority. You still have to play by our rules. And so it's not clear to me whether there's any actual animosity between the two of them. AOC has said some nice things about Pelosi recently. She voted for her for speaker. I think, you know, I talked last week to the head of the Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal, and I think that they are working all together. But Pelosi definitely wants to make clear that she's the speaker and that anything that, you know, comes through Congress is going to have to go through her and that she's kind of she's running the table here.
Hey, Rafe, you know, when I was in high school freshman year, the seniors made sure that we stayed in our freshman lane. How much of that is happening between Pelosi and Ocasio-Cortez?
None of it. I don't think that's it at all. Can I point out something about Pelosi? She's become so cool that she has to pretend she's not doing cool things, like the clap scene around the internet. She's saying, oh, I wasn't really doing anything snarky there. And, of course, it was pretty snarky. But what she's doing really is something Democrats have completely failed to do forever or for a very long time, which is to present an impossible plan, and then what they propose ends up being the moderate alternative to it. So the interaction between Pelosi and Ocasio-Cortez is actually more like that, which it's like the Medicare for All now makes Obamacare look like a kind of dowdy sort of thoughtful plan that, you know, might be actually worth implementing. So I think that's the dynamic. At the same time, though, yeah. I think not senior freshman, I think it's speaker member.
Mm.
And I think Pelosi is reminding everybody, do you remember who the speaker is? And I think she's probably going to do that every few weeks.
Rafe Sonnenschein directs the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Marisa Lagos is a political reporter at KQED. Rafe, Marisa, see you next week.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks, A.
More Take Two coming right up.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Babies who are born premature often spend a lot of time in intensive care as they continue to grow and develop. Researchers at UCLA's Mattel Children's Hospital are using music therapy to make the experience better for families and also help preemies go home faster. KPCC's Priska Neely has a story.
Jamie Middleton gave birth to her little son, Julian, just 6.5 months into the pregnancy. He was 11 weeks early and weighed less than 3 pounds.
Very, very tiny and bright red.
At first, he was in an incubator, connected to a respirator, feeding tube, an IV, in the neonatal intensive care unit, the NICU.
It was hard to see the baby with everything on him, you know?
She couldn't hold him and soothe him like she wanted to.
There's not a lot that you can do as a NICU parent. And a lot of times you have limitations to how you can comfort your baby.
But a few days after he was born, she found something that made a difference. The hospital's music therapy program. As Julian wakes up from a nap, music therapist Sandra Chia serenades him with a special song.
Julian, you're safe and sound.
Chia worked with Julian's parents to reimagine this John Lennon classic as a love song for their son. And they made a recording he could listen to when his parents weren't there.
This is something that we're able to give to him that makes us feel really connected.
My beautiful, 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 beautiful boy.
The music therapists are also using this to help Julian develop a basic skill he needs before he can go home, eating. Babies who are born 6 weeks early or more have to learn how to suck, swallow, and breathe at the same time.
Because they are born so early, they haven't fully developed those muscles and that sucking response and the reflexes.
That's Jenna Ballard, who manages art therapies at UCLA Mattel Children's Hospital. To help babies transition from feeding tubes to bottle or breast, they are using a device called the Pacifier Activated Lullaby, the PAL.
It's time for the PAL.
In Julian's crib, there's a little speaker, and it's connected to a pacifier.
And when the infant sucks on the pacifier, the lullaby that we have recorded with the parents will then play as positive reinforcement every time the infant sucks.
Babies practice with this device for 15 minutes a day.
They learn really quickly that when they suck, they get this beautiful lullaby sound. It encourages the infant to keep sucking for longer and to strengthen their suck.
It's hard to hear, but that song, Beautiful Boy, is playing very quietly at a volume that's developmentally appropriate for Julian's little ears. This FDA-approved device is being used at hospitals across the country. It's been shown to help babies start feeding faster and shave days off of hospital stays. This can make a big difference because each day in the NICU can cost thousands of dollars.
It's also very powerful for the parents and for the quality of life of the baby.
That's Jane Stanley, the Florida State University music therapist who invented the PAL.
The babies will thrive better at home than they will in the hospital because when they go home, they can be held, they can be nurtured.
The UCLA music therapists are collecting data in the hopes that the PAL can become part of routine care for preemies at the hospital. So far, they're seeing good results for the development of babies and parents like Middleton who get involved in the songwriting process.
There's like little rays of sunshine in having baby in the ICU.
Her son Julian got visits from music therapists and used the PAL almost every day during his 8-week stay in the NICU.
As you can see, he really likes to eat.
He's a strong bottle feeder now, and he's ready to go home.
Mm-hmm.
Middleton and her husband plan to create a special playlist for Julian, adding to it every year until his 18th birthday. It will start with the one they recorded when he was just 2 pounds, 13 ounces.
Be happy, be brave, be healthy, just be you.
Covering early childhood, I'm Priska Neely.
You can see photos of Julian and the pacifier-activated lullaby system at our website, laist.com. Moving on, whether or not you personally like the cold weather we've been having recently, one thing out there most definitely does not, and that's batteries, especially the batteries that power electric vehicles. According to a new report from AAA, cold weather can decrease EVs' range and fuel economy, especially when drivers crank up the heat to warm up the cabin. Megan McKernan manages the Auto Club's Automotive Research Center, which conducted the study, and she joins us by phone with all the details. Megan, welcome to Take Two.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Now, this AAA study looked at the batteries in five different electric vehicles, tested them at three different temperatures, 20 degrees, 75 degrees, and 95 degrees Fahrenheit. So let's start with the cold weather effects on EVs. What did your research reveal?
Well, our research revealed that in cold temperatures, there were significant decreases in driving range for these vehicles, in particular when the HVAC system is being used. That would be your heater or your air conditioning. So, of course, if the temperature's cold outside, you're cranking up the heat, that's going to have a much more significant impact on your range.
Now, when it comes to the temperatures that affect EV range, give us some specifics.
On average, when the outside temperature was 20 degrees Fahrenheit, we saw a 12% decrease in driving range. When the outside temperature is 95 degrees, we saw a decrease in 4%. So for the average driver in driving around in these temperatures, they're going to see their ranges drop, 30 miles, 40 miles, depending on what the total range is of the vehicle they have.
So if you have a long trip planned for the morning and you just let your car sit overnight and it's cold, you might be in for a shorter trip than you think?
That's right. Now, what we recommend is if you can precondition your vehicle, and that is turn the heat on, for example, while the vehicle is still plugged into your charger at home, that would really help out because the cabin will be warm once you get in, and you won't need to crank up the heat quite as much.
Yeah, everyone loves to do that. I do that with my car. I don't have an electric car, but everyone loves that, especially on a chilly morning. Now, Megan, here in LA, we don't get that cold. I mean, typically, temperatures this week have dipped into the 30s from time to time. One of our staffers here at Take Two said that was enough to knock 20 miles of charge off her Tesla while it was just sitting in the parking lot. Megan, how cold is cold enough to affect an electric vehicle's ability to hold a charge?
In this particular study, we looked at only the 20 degrees, the 75, and the 95. Mm. So I don't have specific numbers to give you for anything in between. But definitely anything colder than your average 75 is going to have an effect.
Now, it isn't just cold weather that affects batteries. Hot weather does the same thing. Effects aren't quite as bad, aren't they?
Correct. On average, we saw a 4% decrease when the temperature outside was 95 degrees. And that, of course, is without using the air conditioning. Once you're using the air conditioning, we saw a decrease of 17%.
So we basically just need to just drive the car and not worry about temperature inside, it sounds like.
Right. Now, of course, we don't want our drivers out there to suffer, in particular in the cold. So using things like heated seats, heated steering wheel, preconditioning that cabin and keeping the heat on while the vehicle's plugged in will really help.
Talking to Megan McKernan, she manages the Auto Club's Automotive Research Center. Now, when it comes to the temperatures that affect EV range, considering that you studied five different kinds of batteries from five different manufacturers, BMW, Chevrolet, Nissan, Tesla, and Volkswagen, were they all relatively the same in terms of how they were affected, or did some models do maybe better than others?
We found that all of the vehicles were relatively the same. They had the same effects. And we did look at everything in aggregate, so the percentages that I gave you is the average over the five vehicles.
And then there's cost complications too, right? Because the less fuel efficient a car, the more expensive it is to drive it. And EVs typically, at least we think, are more economical to drive per mile than gas-powered cars. So how much more might an EV driver be paying due to colder, hot weather?
Well, for example, on average, for an outside temperature of 20 degrees, we found that this resulted in a cost increase equal to an additional $24.27 for every 1,000 miles driven. And it's not much of a difference. We just wanted to put in those costs to give drivers a perspective.
Now, when it comes to, I'm wondering about this too, when people move from the East Coast to the West Coast, they tend to lose their cold weather toughness. And I'm wondering, do cars that are in Southern California with maybe more temperate climate maybe lose any ability to be tougher in the cold? Or am I just kind of projecting my own views on an inanimate object?
The car will know the difference between the temperatures, but I don't think that, you know, if it spent most of its life in California and then moved to the East Coast, I don't think you'd find any difference.
So, Megan, what should I be considering as a result of your research? I'm sure some people out there listening might be thinking they never want an electric car because of this, but is that the right takeaway?
Well, they definitely should still trust electric cars. We did this study to provide our consumers with information to be better informed and allow them to plan ahead so they can avoid being stranded. So some of the things that we recommend: when drivers are aware that the weather conditions are going to be cold or hot, depending, they should plan for more frequent stops of charging. And if possible, park your vehicle in a garage to help stabilize cabin temperature as opposed to leaving it outside overnight.
All right, Megan McKernan is manager of the Auto Club's Automotive Research Center. She's been speaking with us about a new AAA study that looked at how ambient temperature affects the driving range and fuel economy of battery electric vehicles. Megan, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
Parenting is not a war versus other parents to determine who does it best. At least it shouldn't be, but I know it kind of feels that way sometimes. Say you do something that works really well for your kids, however, it's unconventional and not what the experts say or what other parents do. Well, you know what? Sometimes weird parenting wins. Find out how when Take Two continues.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering 3 psychology master's degrees during the summer term. Convenient locations for working professionals in West LA, Encino, and Irvine. Graduates in psychology, marriage and family therapy, and behavioral psychology are prepared to pursue licensure or a doctorate in their designated field. Classes start in April. Apply by February 15th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, I mean Martinez. All right, so here's the biggest understatement of the decade. Parenting is hard.
When I first had my daughter, I felt like a failure every time I read a parenting book.
That's Hillary Frank, host of the Longest Shortest Time podcast, talking about the push and pull of emotions that's so common with parenting. What started as a chronicle of her experience with a difficult labor and postpartum recovery led her to reach out to other parents for their stories and advice. Now, Frank has written a book that includes some of those stories and tips from her podcast listeners. It's called Weird Parenting Wins. We spoke with Frank about the difficult transition many women face with first-time motherhood.
To me, I didn't feel like myself. I felt like a shell of myself. You know, I just had to live with it as a secret. I was used to being like a creative person. I had been a radio journalist for 10 years, and I had written 3 young adult novels and just really had a hard time identifying as anything other than like an injured mom.
So Hillary, when was the moment when you said to yourself, I really need to talk about this? I'm going to do a podcast.
You know, what I wanted to do really was connect with other moms and hear their truths about struggles in motherhood. And to me, I did it for 2 reasons. One was I knew after a decade of working in radio that if you stick a microphone in somebody's face, you're more likely to get like some truthful answers and you have license to ask them more personal questions. Mm-hmm. And so that was one reason. And the other was I knew that it was really hard for postpartum women to get jobs. And I really wanted a full-time job for the stability of my family.
You know, the thing about it is when it comes to parenting, I mean, there's all kinds of books, there's social media groups, there's blogs. wondering, why do you think right now in this time that we need this?
I mean, I think we've probably needed this all along. And it's not so much that we need it now, but people are being more open about it now. And when I started The Longest Shortest Time, I didn't know of other books even that were really going into depth on this stuff, because it was like refreshing to hear that they weren't alone.
Now, the book Weird Parenting Wins: Bathtub Dining, Family Screams, and Other Hacks from the Parenting Trenches. So how did you figure out to try and crowdsource all this stuff into one book?
So in 2013, I did a blog post on the Longest Shortest Time website where I talked about how when I first had my daughter, I felt like a failure every time I read a parenting book. And I only realized after doing this for a couple years that the things that really worked for me were not things I had learned in books. They were things that I had discovered in moments of desperation and out of trial and error, or things that friends had discovered and they shared with me. And I asked listeners if they had any of these things that they had invented themselves that they could share, like what was working for them. And I got all of these responses back, and they were so hilarious and so weird. You know, there was like the dad who pig snorted in his infant's ear to get her to stop crying. There was, you know, another parent who like would charge up an electric toothbrush, like sort of conduct the baby to sleep because the vibrations would be like white noise. But I just loved the creativity behind them. And eventually we had hundreds of them.
Talking to Hillary Frank, her new book is called Weird Parenting Wins. Now, Hillary, you set up the book, at least the chapters, with The Art of Blank, The Art of Soothing a Screaming Child is chapter one. Chapter two, The Art of Getting Your Kid to Eat Stuff. Why set it up as an art form?
I think because so often we're made to feel like it's the opposite of art.
Like it's a science.
Yeah, that it's a science. But when it comes to things like your technique for getting a kid to stop crying, I do think it's an art and there's nuance to it.
Hillary, one of the stories in your book early on is your daughter was kind of whining a little bit, and you decided to sing the blues to try and kind of keep her mind off of whining. In a situation like that, when a kid is acting out, how do you stay in the presence of mind to be creative and try to control that situation when a lot of parents would just throw up their hands and maybe yell back at a kid?
Oh, and I've been there too. I mean, I think it's not going to be every situation where you can take a deep breath and, you know, tell your kid you can't whine, you got to sing the blues. But there's a whole chapter in the book on keeping your cool, you know, most of the time. So like there's one trick that I love that this mom came up with where she grabs duct tape, puts it over her mouth and draws on a smile whenever she feels like she's going to yell. Because then it makes the kid laugh, it makes her laugh. I think distraction can be really key in those moments.
Now, I want to talk about chapter two, the one I mentioned, The Art of Getting Your Kid to Eat Stuff. Tell us about that chapter and what you had to do to get your kid to eat what you wanted him to eat.
She was going through this phase of really not liking lettuce. Mm-hmm. And I don't blame her. Like, lettuce can be pretty boring. But I showed her, it was the first SNL digital short that was ever made. It's called Lettuce. And it features Andy Samberg and Will Forte, and they're sitting on like a New York stoop, and they seem to be talking about like a friend who died. They're like mourning somebody. Mm-hmm. And as they're mourning this person and having this conversation, they're taking these giant chomps of a ball of iceberg lettuce. And then she was like, get me a lettuce. And from then on, she has liked lettuce.
Did any lettuce get in her belly?
Yeah, she ate up. She eats it still now. Yeah. She asks for crunchy lettuce.
You know, and part of this, too, and I guess every parent has gone through this, is when it comes to getting your kid to eat something, you need them to ingest. I think maybe flat out lying is part of the equation. I'll give you an example, Hillary. My granddaughter, 4 years old, we needed her to take medicine that she did not like the taste of. So my wife went up to her and said, you don't have to drink this medicine. We'll just go to the doctor and you can get a shot instead. The next thing my granddaughter did is reach for that medicine and drank it down. We got her to do what we needed her to do. Is that okay?
I mean, I think so much of parenting is that, you know, white lies seem to be necessary.
Yeah.
And especially when they're really little, there are some times when you just need them to do a certain thing. In the best case scenario, it's like a fun story you can tell them when they grow up.
parenting these days, Hillary, just seems so relentless. It just feels like the pressure's always on to do the exact right thing at the exact right time, and then to have other parents, parent peers, be approving of how you do things. I mean, do you share that when it comes to parenting these days? It's just one relentless track meet?
Yeah, and I don't know how new that is. I mean, there's a history to judgy parenting, but I think that parenting is so high stakes that we want to think we're doing it right. And so when we pick a side and we see someone else doing it a different way, it's really easy to be like, oh, well, they must be doing it wrong.
Okay, Hillary, what do you want people that pick up your book, Weird Parenting Wins, what do you want them to get out of it in the end?
I want them to see parents all over the world are trying weird stuff and unexpected things are working for them. And so, like, the next time some weird thing occurs to you that you think might help you in some situation with your kid, try it. Like, trust your own instincts.
Hillary Frank's book is called Weird Parenting Wins. Hillary, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Do you have a weird parenting win that you'd like to share with other parents? You can tweet me at amartinezla or tweet the show at Take Two. I know she tried. All right, when I was a kid, I loved riding a Greyhound bus. That shiny metal lower half capped by a red, white, and blue shell with a silver running Greyhound logo in full stride. I always made sure to have the seat right above it when I got on the bus. You can meet all kinds of folks from all kinds of places near and far on a Greyhound bus. Coming up, we'll hear about an exhibit in downtown LA that tells some of their stories through pictures and songs. That's ahead in 60 seconds. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I mean, Martinez. Doug Leavitt has traveled the equivalent of several times around the planet on a bus. Well, the Greyhound, to be exact. What started out as a way to get around and share his music turned into a multimedia documentation of his fellow riders in songs, stories, and images. And an exhibit about it opens today at the Museum of Social Justice in downtown Los Angeles. We caught up with Leavitt earlier this week and asked him to share his story.
I'm Doug Leavitt, and I'm the creator of the Greyhound Diaries. Greyhound Diaries is a project that I started more than 12 years and 120,000 bus miles back, in which I've taken these extended journeys and written songs and stories and gathered images of fellow riders along the way. The idea, in part, was to paint a greater portrait of those people who are generally lesser reflected in American society. In my 20s, I was a London-based foreign correspondent covering conflict zones for ABC and CNN primarily. Underneath, I knew I was an artist, and I had been writing songs and been writing music and had been writing all along the way, and I figured if I didn't do it then, I wasn't going to do it. And returning home to the States, I saw all this disparity that had grown, and I felt, well, what could I do with my strange skill set, such as it was? I decided that I would set out by bus and write songs and stories about people struggling to get by, and then along the way, I perform in VAs, shelters, prisons, theaters, stations, anything in between. There are such vast distances when you travel by bus that you have these stops and meal breaks and smoke breaks, and you have bus maintenance at 2 o'clock in the morning. And so there's all of this getting on and off the bus that creates sort of a slow reveal to a story. And then, of course, because of these distances, there is the opportunity and in a lot of ways need for connection to pass the time. And also there's something about the anonymity of sitting next to someone you may never ever see again, almost side by side as in a confessional or a bar, and certainly people of various backgrounds. My trepidation about traveling by Greyhound was probably greater than the actuality, of course. Even though on the bus you'll have recently released ex-offenders and you have those who are heading back into prison and you have people of just a wide background, because of the way you travel, I've never really felt scared in any way, shape, or form. There are in the United States 25 times the number of destinations by bus as there are by the largest airline in America. And so, so many of these stations are tiny depots that you reach, you know, in the middle of the night or you pass through. So it's a complete kind of snapshot in some ways of urban realities, of rural realities. I hope that people will be moved and moved to action of some small form, whatever that is. The populations who travel by bus include a lot of veterans. I mean, there are 2.7 million veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the two longest declared wars in American history, waged at the same time by those who travel by bus. And the VA and a lot of other organizations, they need volunteers. Same is true for ex-offender programs. Same is true for addiction, the kind of entwined epidemics of mental health, mental illness, and addiction. So I hope that it will increase a level of empathy and awareness and understanding.
He said, "Daddy, I'm rich." I said, "Son, if we were rich, we wouldn't be right."
That was Doug Levitt, creator of the Greyhound Diaries. His multimedia exhibit about the 12 years he spent traveling on Greyhound buses and documenting his fellow travelers opens at the Museum for Social Justice in downtown LA on Saturday.
I am a better dad if I'm a better man.
Finally, the week's almost over, and we can help you plan your time off.
Hey, I'm Christine Ziemba from LAist.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. If this cold snap's got you down, well, snap out of it. There's a lot of great things to do outside this weekend.
Fans of typewriters, poetry, and printed goods need to check out this event. You're Just My Type is a Valentine's Day paper arts festival. It's being held at the Dynasty Typewriter at the Hayworth Theater in Westlake from noon to 4 p.m. on Saturday. And you don't need a boo or a bay to use one of the vintage typewriters on site to type up notes and missives. Poets will be there on hand to help you create poetry, and calligraphers will be there to help address or write up your own notes. Vendors and artists will be selling their wares, too. Best of all, this festival is free with RSVP.
Then, if you're looking to heat up your cold weekend, here's another event for you. Tomorrow afternoon in Hawthorne is the SoCal Hot Sauce Fest. So, sauce makers from around the area will be on hand for taste tests, demos, and to sell their sauce. Plus, this takes place at Common Space Brewery, so there will be drinks on hand for you to buy and cool your tongue. This is also a family-friendly space, so kids and even dogs are welcomed. And this event is free.
Now, here's a great reason to get gussied up on Saturday night. The 10th annual Edwardian Ball takes place over at the Fonda Theater in Hollywood beginning at 8 p.m. The party honors the artistic and literary contributions from cult author and illustrator Edward Gorey. The night features live music, theater, art installations, dancing, DJs, and cosplay. Steampunk attire is not required, but do dress to impress. And tickets will cost you $60.
Finally, Happy New Year! Yeah, just this week, we marked the Lunar New Year, the Year of the Pig, and many celebrations are going on. But one to see happens tomorrow night at the Segerstrom Center in Costa Mesa. There will be free performances on the plaza from traditional Chinese folk dancers to dancers from the OCK Pop Academy. Then, if you really want to splurge, you can buy tickets for the performance inside the center. There, the Pacific Symphony features traditional songs mixed with opera singers, dancers, and more. And tickets start at $68. Now, there's a lot more going on here this weekend. You can check out our whole list of events on LAist.com. That is LAIST.com.
I'm Christine Ziemba from LAist.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. And
have
see you later.
Have a good weekend.
All right. right, that's it for Take Two this week. Our producer is Leo Duran. Emily Henderson helped out this week. Tamika Adams is our news apprentice. The show was edited by Sue Carpenter. Austin Cross and Lori Galarreta direct the show. And our fabulous engineer is Hasmik Pogosian. Senior producer is Megan Larson. You can find us on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. You can find me Twitter and Instagram, same place, at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. Thanks for listening, and thanks for trusting us with your time. I'm Martinez. Take Two. We'll be back Monday at 2:00.